welcome to Hawk Weekly.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jonathan.
I'm Crystal.
And this is Haunt Weekly, a weekly podcast for the haunted attraction and haunted entertainment industry. Whether you're an actor, owner, or just plain aficionado, we aim to be a podcast for you. And this week, folks, we have a rare treat for you. We are very excited about this.
Yes.
We had the opportunity to meet this week's guest at HauntCon. Crystal is devouring her book as we speak. I'm sure she'll have plenty to ask about that. And we have easily the most overqualified person to ever be on this podcast. Our current guest this week is Margie Kerr. She has a PhD that is, turns out, not just letters that were randomly selected to sound fancy, in sociology from the University of Pittsburgh. She has been on Full Frontal. She's been featured in Time, History, the New York Times, all over the place, literally just an absolutely insane amount of media she's been in, and yet somehow she's here today. I am blown away by this. Margie Kerr, the sociologist of who studies fear, thank you for coming on the show.
Yes. Well, yeah, thank you for having me on. It was such a pleasure meeting you guys at HauntCon and talking, so happy to be here.
Yes. So real fast, tell us what it means to be a sociologist who studies fear. What does this mean to you?
Well, I am really interested in understanding how fear is constructed in time and place, and how different cultures, are afraid of different things, but also express fear in different ways, and just have different meaning and, kind of associations to fear. So looking at how it changes by culture is very, very interesting to me. And I think that there's so many different layers to fear to look at. So I do focus on the more, social aspects of fear. So how it works in groups and how people, kind of express fear between each other. I really just look at how fear is constructed.
And we have another guest this week.
Yes, I'm so sorry.
It's okay. No,
that's okay.
I've got a house full of cats, and they love to make themselves known.
Go back to our early episodes. You will see that our cats were quite intrusive in the early weeks for us, too. In fact, more so, they were bumping the mic stand, which ticked me off. But go ahead.
Yeah, so back to this. So you mentioned the difference in fear in groups versus individuals. If someone's going through a haunted house, by themselves, are they more likely or less likely to show as many fear signs as with a group?
It depends on a lot of factors. So there have been some studies looking at how people express fear by themselves versus with a group, but they've been done mostly in movie theaters. So people who watch a movie by themselves do tend to be more expressive. So, scream louder or have more kind of exaggerated facial features or less. They're not trying to manage their expressions as much. But with a group, when groups go into haunted attractions or any highly stimulating environment, they're not only experiencing the space, but also thinking about how they want to do impression management. So, people might be very worried about coming off as too afraid, or, people may be wanting to have very exaggerated reactions. So when we're alone, we're not thinking about any of that impression management. So our expressions are going to be more just, kind of instinctual and happen without much thought. But, when we're in a group, we are weighing those competing motivations to impress people or, to take on whatever kind of role in that specific instance.
Okay.
One thing you've talked a great deal about both in your book and we'll get the plug in the full book later. I definitely want to do that. but in your book and your talks and elsewhere has been about why we enjoy fear. And on the surface, that seems insane. I think I can't remember which comedian it was, but he talked about how you don't see deer strapping headlights to their antlers and charging at each other in the woods.
Oh, that's me.
This is a decidedly human thing, but we do it, and as you noted, it transcends culture that we do this. It's almost a universal thing that we do this to each other and to ourselves. Why?
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting because you do see some behaviors in the animal world that might come close to our self-scaring or you know, voluntarily getting scared. When animals play fight or, you know, engage in kind of very endurance heavy challenges, you know, the thinking of the animals kind of bucking heads, or just any kind of play fighting that you see among animals, there's likely some similar systems at work behind that, because a lot of the benefits that we get from scaring ourselves, it's the physical activation of, you know, all of these different chemicals that are going to, you know, can create a feeling of strength and power, because we've got all of the all of our energy going towards our muscles and making sure that we're feeling strong and ready to fight or flee. And so in a lot of ways, going through a haunted house is like, you know, doing a 5K marathon or a really challenging rock climb. It's something that's stressful and strenuous, but we know that we'll be safe and have a guaranteed survival, ideally. So then it's just a personal challenge that we can feel proud about surviving, even though we know it's fake.
Okay. So... And you talked also about the group dynamic, and that's something Crystal alluded to just a second ago, and why we do this with groups and how it's a bonding mechanism. But I've got to say, is this like likened to like a hazing thing where groups go through haunts together, the bond and get closer? Is it like a hazing thing, or is it, you know, something different? I'm trying to understand the response there, because I've seen it, but I don't understand it. And I think you might be the one to understand it.
Yeah. There's at the kind of most basic level, we do tend to bond with people in high stress situations. But the opposite is true also. So, you know, we may bond more closely to those that we're with and have positive feelings towards. So if we're with our friends and we do something, you know, highly stressful or fun or emotional, we'll create stronger memories. And if those are positive memories, we'll have positive associations. But on the other hand, if it's with somebody who is, you know, stressing us in a very negative way, someone we don't like or don't trust, it can intensify the negative associations. So it can go both ways. But in environments like haunted attractions or amusement parks or watching scary movies where the goal is entertainment and fun, you know, it's a bonding that is built from just sharing a very intense emotional experience. So it's scary, but you're there. You all want to be there. So it's not hazing, I think, the lines of consent and whether or not people really would choose to be there, you know, is questionable. I think that if when it crosses that line into real, you know, torture, where the goal is hurting someone rather than, you know, people having an entertaining time, the bonding is going to be different.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we know what you're alluding to in that, at least to some degree.
Yeah.
So, and the other thing you're saying is don't go to haunted houses with people I hate, because I'll hate them more.
Yep.
Got it. I don't think I was in any danger of doing that, because that sounds really stupid. But hey, well, it's a good tip.
We've been in line and stuck with some people that were less than ideal.
You know what? And I'll say this. We've been paired in escape rooms. I mean, I know it's not haunted, but it's a intense situation with people that we didn't like when we went in with them. And then really hated them on the eggs. Looking at you, Tony, exactly. You know what you did.
That is, you know, it's so true. And it's one of the things I do a lot of consulting with different attractions and in doing their surveys and talking to their customers, being partnered or paired with people that they don't like, or if there's some sort of confrontation, it really does kind of put a shadow over the entire experience. So it is, and it is, especially for puzzle rooms, it is a challenge that I know a lot are trying to figure out. You know, what do you do when you have a 10-person puzzle room and you've got, you know, a group of five and a group of five, and whoops, they hate
it. And they're jets and sharks or something. I don't know.
Right. What are you going to do? So,
yeah. So backpedaling just a bit, how did you get into this, and what's your love of this kind of research?
Yeah, I began working in research focused on health disparities and looking at how, you know, often fear is behind discrimination and just different, you know, fear often keeps groups apart. And so a lot of my focus early on was trying to, you know, reduce fear so that we could, you know, attain equality in general. And so I really focused on it as a negative force. My dissertation actually looked at how parents very successfully were able to use, you know, fear in arguing the case that vaccines cause autism. So it was just, you know, you scare parents and they you tell them that something bad is going to happen to their kids, and it's very motivating. But as I was kind of continuing on, I realized there's a whole other side of fear. That, you know, there are people who want to do scary things, who want to scare themselves. And it was just one of those moments of why, you know, why, like earlier, why would we want to do this? So that really took me down another path to try and understand fear from all perspectives, you know, how it has, you know, allowed us to survive, you know, and evolve. And it's just the matter of being scared of the right things.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. You started out with your intrigue seemed to start out with studying how fear was being used to make people less safe.
Right.
Away right. from vaccines. And now you're looking at how to use fear to make people, you know, more safe in various ways, whether it's more closely bonded with their friends or, you know, practicing fight or flight. So
right.
on.
So exactly. I love the practicing part is definitely true. I think the more people understand how their body responds in times of stress, the more confident they can feel in just their everyday life. You know, of course, being scared in a haunted house isn't the same thing as being scared, you know, in the real world, but you still do gain an awareness and understanding of your body and start to, you know, understand how you can get very stressed, but you're going to come back down, you know, that it's not always going to be the Mach 10 kind of feeling.
That's interesting. And also you learn about, like, how your body responds. So I hadn't actually thought of this. This is intriguing because, like, you know, if you're in a haunt and you're a runner, for example, you get scared and just boom, you're gone. You know, that's going to be one of your immediate responses in any stressful situation.
Yeah. And a lot of people, you know, if they only associate that heart racing, anxiety feeling with negative environments, then, you know, going to a haunted house or amusement park is going to give them a whole different environment to associate those feelings to. So maybe when they're in the boardroom or giving a speech in front of a lot of people, they can remind themselves that, oh, this feeling isn't always, you know, terrifying. It's just excitement. I'm not terrified to speak in front of 100 people. I'm excited to. So I think it gives people an idea of how they can kind of really just carve their own experiences with the physiological reactions.
Crystal, we're changing our marketing. It's now going on a self-improvement theme. I think we could start marketing this. I think we could do something with this. I'm not sure why, but I think this is an angle we have to attack. But yeah, that's absolutely fascinating because, and like you said, the other thing is even if it is still a negative feeling for you, having it in a safe environment like a haunt or a roller coaster tells you that it will pass.
Right. Yep.
In 5-10 minutes, your heart rate will return to normal and you'll be back to where you were.
Yep.
And life goes on. And then,
right. Yes.
It's kind of like I tell people an experience I had in middle school. I was always so scared to talk to women. I would talk to girls when I was growing up. And everyone looks at me now like that's absolutely insane. But it's true. I was terrified. Mm-hmm. But I did it. I remember I asked out the prettiest girl in school. She shot me down, absolutely cold, vicious blood in the hallway. I mean, it was brutal. Mm-hmm. And then that was the worst that could happen.
Yeah.
It's over.
A lot of our fear is tied up in that anticipation. When we look at how the body is responding to a threat that they know is coming, but they don't know when, it's all the anticipation, all mm-hmm. the activity, everything that's really increasing that feeling of tension in your body is happening before the exposure. And once the exposure happens, that's when we start to see the winding down. So I do like to remind people, especially with things that are not truly a threat to them, spiders, yes, there are some very dangerous spiders, but you know, if someone doesn't want that to impact their everyday life, then you can kind of do mental exercises to imagine, okay, what's the worst that could happen here? Or with public speaking, you know, what's the worst that can happen? And you know, just prepare yourself for that and recognize that, you know, if we can kind of just get through that really tough anticipation part and see that it's not going to be as bad as we've made it out in our mind, then we can start to kind of overcome.
Yeah. And Jonathan mentioned roller coasters, and I actually love roller coasters, but I hate heights. So your descriptions of the ones overseas...
Oh, yeah.
Or like my fear response was kicking in just reading about what you were going through. So, yeah, it's very well written.
Oh, thank you. It's so funny. When I think back and I just close my eyes and imagine myself, you know, on some of the roller coasters in Japan at Fuji Q Highland, I can still feel, you know, the stomach drop and the disorientation and the just going up that hill. And gosh, that. Oh, it was just so beautiful.
I'm making a note to go to Japan for roller coasters right now.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I know, even as scared as I am even reading it, I would probably still get on it and do it.
Yeah. You know. That's one of the most amazing things about the human brain is that we can imagine these experiences and feel it in our body just by reading a story or, you know, watching or hearing a story. Of course, the real thing is going to be more intense, but it's the fact that we can just imagine it is pretty cool.
Right.
That it's absolutely amazing how powerful the human imagination really is.
It is.
I'm always blown away by it. I mean, so one thing I find personally very interesting is haunted attractions. We think of them as a primarily U.S. thing. I mean, we have the connection to Halloween. We have the attachment to it. But they're starting to really sort of branch nationally and branch internationally now. So what are some of the ways in which fear is different culturally that haunted attractions might run into?
Well, it is interesting. And what I've seen in Japan and South America is that while there definitely is an exporting of the American style haunted house. In fact, in Japan, I think I went to one that was called American Style.
They're not very good with titles in Japan sometimes. Very direct.
And they, you know, it really is walking through them is like walking through the trade show at a convention. You see all of the popular props and the popular sets and scares, and it's an American attraction. That was the case in Bogota, the one I went through. They had personalized it, interestingly, with a lot of political graffiti in their 3D area, but otherwise it was recognizable American props and items. The places where you see the real kind of homegrown or the culturally specific ones are usually outside of the amusement parks and in some of the neighborhoods. And in Japan, they do have their own traditions of the attractions. They're more in Japan focused on, you know, ghosts and haunting and are beginning to incorporate some of the, you know, familiar monsters from the U.S. But there, you know, it's a representation of the very deep-seated fear around a bad death and what happens, you know, after a bad death with ghosts haunting and houses, you know, kind of being tied to the ghosts. Whereas in Bogota, they didn't really have their own haunted attractions, at least that I could find. But you did see some horror movies and some, you know, I think that they had a kind of a semi-popular zombie genre there. But with the growth of the American-style haunted attraction and, you know, increasing just connection between all countries, I will be interested to see how cultures take the American style and make it their own and modify it. And that will, I think, be pretty cool.
Yeah, we just got, in fact, this we do haunted attraction news every month. Mm-hmm. Not that long ago, I think the first American-style haunted attraction opened up in Dubai.
Right, yeah. I actually know some of the folks who worked on that. And it was, you know, a lot of the just straight export of American props and designs and then built in Dubai. Dubai is a fascinating place. It's mostly, most of the people who live there are not from there. But yeah, it's a
Dubai scares me a little bit.
Yeah, it's very, very popular. It's popular for tourism and also where very, very rich people can go for privacy, apparently.
Well, good to know. When I get very, very rich,
yeah, you can buy your own island.
I'll buy my own island in Dubai. See, this is a good sales pitch here.
Yeah.
But tell me about some of the work you do with the haunted attraction industry. I know you work closely with Scarehouse.
Yeah, I worked with Scarehouse for a long time, and then I moved out to Philadelphia almost 2 years ago now, and have worked with Terror Behind the Walls at Eastern State Penitentiary.
One of our bucket list haunts, for the record.
Yeah, they're my So I've got a great relationship with them, and do a lot of work with them every season. But when typically attractions, or I work with museums a lot too on exhibits. Are interested in just, you know, different ways to create spaces that are going to tap into our senses, you know, without too much conscious awareness. So more thinking about different props that incorporate sound or light or smell, just balancing all of those to create really good scares. And also I do a lot of education and training for staff and actors on, you know, why just screaming at somebody for 30 minutes isn't going to work, and why, you know, going for the over the top scare is not always the best option. So that's my favorite part is doing some of the training. And then I really do enjoy the surveying of the customers, you know, finding out what they like and what they don't like. And then giving that back to the attraction so that they can modify and make improvements.
That sounds good.
Yeah.
Now you touched a little bit on senses, and that's something that you cover a lot in your book. And it's actually what I saw you talk on at Hong Kong. Would you care to touch on that a bit and how we can use it as an industry?
Sure. Yeah. There's so many great little tips and tricks that can activate or kind of stimulate, incite our natural responses to stimuli that aren't on the surface scary, but can be very effective in a haunted attraction. So, you know, instead of just putting strobe lights everywhere, thinking about like an actual design for strobe that is going to be the most disorienting. So research has found different patterns and frequencies can impact us and leave us feeling more distorted than just a, you know, flashing dance party kind of thumping strobe light. So also touch is really powerful. And even if you're in a non-touching haunt, there are different ways to incorporate textures and temperatures into the environment that people can touch that will enhance the experience. So I like, you know, thinking about that using a lot of the just research from, you know, affective scientists. So people who study emotions to enhance the experience, lots of visual distortions and playing with color and perspective. But yeah, it's, and sound, I love sound.
Is there anything that people should maybe stay away from, especially things that you've seen used in haunt or overused?
Yeah, I think that there are two things that come to mind immediately that can be potentially very dangerous. And that's sound that's too loud. You know, a lot of haunters.
Oh, God.
Yeah, working around.
Sorry, this is a personal gripe for me too.
Yeah, my hearing is not the same, and I know it's because I've been around some very loud environments, and so I always caution designers to really think about their volume. You know, you start turning it up, and you know, at the beginning of the night, you're thinking, oh gosh, that's so loud, but by the middle of the night, you're like, oh, maybe we should turn the sound up. And the answer to that is no.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. So we can do real harm to people if something is too loud, especially if it's a startle sound right at ear level. If it's too loud, it can be painful, and that's going to take somebody out of the experience. So, you know, I recommend finding a setting that you test among different people and just keeping it there, trusting the setting, trust the math. And then the other thing is smell. I think that it smells not going to be dangerous if you're using just, you know, scent boxes, but if it's too strong, it will very quickly take people out of an experience. So it can be super effective. So many of these things are scaled kind of like they can be just as damaging as they can be effective. So a really good scent box can make all the difference. A really bad one can also make all the difference. But as soon as we smell something that is just either highly disgusting or out of place, it could take the person out of the experience, and they're not going to pay attention to anything. They're not even going to get scared. They're just going to be focused on getting out of the room to get away from the smell. Right. So
what about a smell that people wouldn't necessarily be familiar with?
That, I think, is one of the most exciting avenues for haunts to grow. You know, I think in my seminar at HauntCon, I talk about, you know, knowing your demographic and your population. If you're attraction that's located in a very dense urban environment, a lot of the kids, a lot of the people who come may not be familiar with smells like sawdust or like and pine, or a lot of the smells that you might find in barns. So sure, you can throw in the butcher smells and the, you know, decaying flesh, but these novel smells that are new and different and interesting are also going to be captivating and immersive, you know, if they're in the right scene. You don't necessarily want to have, you know, fresh peppermint in a decaying butcher scene, but, you know, having different smells that people aren't used to can really just ground them in the moment in a very cool way.
Yeah, one thing, you're talking about sound, one thing I think a lot of haunts don't understand is I've been to a couple haunts where they have those poppers, mm-hmm. and they use them too close to ears and whatever. And the thing about it is you're only in a haunt for, say, 10 to 30 minutes tops, mm-hmm. in that range somewhere. If you cause my ears to start ringing or something early on, they're not going to readjust until it's over.
Right. So
You just muted everything else in the haunt.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And we do, you know, our senses do have a limit, have a saturation point. And that's why the balancing in attractions is so important. If you just have strobe and loud sounds the whole time, after about, you know, 5 minutes or even less, you're going to be just numb to it. That balance is so key.
And that makes the point that you were talking about earlier about varying the sights, yes. sounds, and smells, and also the scares too.
Absolutely.
And the importance of bringing that variety in, because if you, like I said, you saturate something, and we've seen it in haunts that we toured where they'll do a scare once and it pops and it works great. Then they do it again, like right after, and then again and again. And by the fourth time, everyone's more annoyed than they are scared. And then,
yes. Yeah. Yep. It's, and you know, if you think about the core parts of fear, it's that uncertainty. So if you're just getting the same scare again and again, there's nothing uncertain there. There's nothing to fear. And that's why, you know, I think that when haunters or designers, get frustrated because, you know, their customers might be saying, oh, it's gotta be scarier. It doesn't always mean that things have to be more extreme. Really what they're saying, if, and not that I can speak for all customers, but is that they want something unexpected and something different. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, more violent or bloody or you know, horrendous and gruesome. It just means thinking more creatively and more outside the box. And I think those challenges are fun and, you know, bring a lot of innovation and creativity.
Yeah, that's a very, very good point there about how when people say they want more scared, it's kind of like how when people say they want better graphics in video games, what they really want is better aesthetics.
Yeah.
The customers don't always know how to word what they want. They don't necessarily want a harder, more aggressive scare. They want something that impacts them more deeply. And that sometimes the less aggressive scare is what will actually impact them.
Yeah. And there was recently a really good article on customer expectations and satisfaction. And it is difficult for customers to articulate exactly what they want, especially if it's right, you know, because they're there for entertainment. They're there not to think. So then, you know, trying to figure out what it is they want, it's not always easy. So that's why I love doing the surveys and talking to people and trying to figure out, like, when you say that you want scarier, what is it exactly that you mean? And I've asked that question a lot and feel like I'm, you know, getting a better understanding of what it is they're saying when they say that.
Yeah. So when, from these surveys and things, because there's a tendency in the industry to start going to more extreme kind of style haunts because they hear, we want more, we want more.
And so yeah, that's how we get our blackouts or McCamey Manors and all that stuff.
Yeah. Is that not actually people are asking for?
Well, I don't think that it's definitely not the only thing people are asking for. I mean, I think that the percentage of the population that is really highly motivated to go to those experiences, mm-hmm. They're going to find them and they're going to go. But if we're talking just mainstream Halloween season, going out to a haunted attraction, I think that it is just things that are new and different rather than more extreme. Things that are memorable. People want to have those awe-inspiring moments and not awe-inspiring in the, you know, puppy dogs and sunshine, but like, oh my God, that is awesome. What am I seeing, you know, in front of me?
Yeah.
So I think that it's unfortunate that we often only think of, you know, more scary means more extreme means more kind of the simulated torture. I don't think that that's certainly not what everybody wants. I think they just want a unique experience that's memorable.
I know for us, we go to typically at least a dozen to two dozen haunts every year.
Yeah.
We're in addition to running our home haunt.
Yeah.
We're a little crazy. Yeah. But one of the metrics we always have is at the end of season when it's all done and we've had a little time to breathe, what do we remember?
Right.
What stood out? What rose above? What moments? And that's always an interesting source of conversation because we realize very quickly it's not always the quote-unquote best haunts that gave us the biggest memories.
Right.
Oftentimes it was haunts that were very small or had faced other challenges and maybe, you know, objectively were not very good.
Right.
But they had moments where they really, really shined.
Yep. That was my experience in Japan too. I went to so many attractions, but it was just this tiny little 5-minute attraction that left the biggest impression. That's why I love working with attractions who are open for quick prototyping, you know, trying something and just seeing like, okay, let's just try this thing and see if it lands, see if it works. And some of the most unexpected things have worked phenomenally and I don't think I can share them, but it's just so surprising to see what little things, you know, that you would think, no, this is going to be just, people are going to laugh and it's not going to work. And it ends up just being the standout moments. So yeah, being able to prototype and have different kinds of, which is difficult, you know, if you're a smaller attraction, it's tough to, you know, just switch everything up that you've been working on. But there are little tweaks and changes, I think, within every attraction that you can, you know, test out to see how it lands.
Okay, this brings, oh, sorry. Well, do you want to, okay. This brings me actually to a point that I've been wondering with us and our haunt and what we do and also versus what we see at other haunts. I've noticed that when customers go to a haunt having an expectation that it's going to be super scary and super badass, that they tend to raise their guard up and not get as scared, and they end up walking away a little disappointed. But when they go to a haunt, like maybe that 5-minute little Japanese haunt, your haunt in Japan you're talking about, and they let their guard down a little bit thinking this is going to be nothing, that's when it's easier to get them. And that's the problem. From a marketing standpoint, we have to elevate those expectations. We have to convince people we're the scariest. But from a fear standpoint, it seems more effective to do the opposite.
I know. You know, it's like trying to balance on a rolling log in the log rolling competitions. You know, you're running forward, then you're running backwards, because that's really what marketing is for haunted attractions, because you do have to convince them that it's worthy of coming. And, you know, the idea of haunted attractions is to scare. So intuitively you think, I got to tell people it's the scariest and convince them to come. But then they get there and you want to kind of lower those expectations so they're impressed. And it is hard. It is hard. And I, you know, credit marketing teams who can do that and really, get the message out there that convinces people to come, while at the same time not overselling, not, you know, setting just a kind of bait and switch type of thing, because customers know that they're going to know that they didn't get what they thought that they would. So it is a tough thing to do, and I always suggest to marketing teams, you know, to read a lot of the data on customer satisfaction and surveying that's in academic circles, because it's highly enlightening. And unfortunately, it is true that, you know, you come in with no expectations or slightly low expectations, and you do end up feeling more satisfied.
Yeah, I know our cheesy little home haunt gets some really good, really good pops.
Yeah. So, but then, yeah, how do you turn that around to marketing?
Exactly. Pro haunt, exactly.
Yeah.
So we've been talking a lot about customers and what they get out of it, and what people who like to be scared get out of it. What about the people who like to scare people?
Yeah, that's, you know, I originally in the first draft of my book, I had a whole chapter on the other side. But it just, you know, things get cut and that's okay. But, It is equally as fascinating to look at why people like to scare, and it's so diverse. There's so many reasons, and I have done employee interviews too. And, you know, there are the people who come in and they enjoy the freedom of expression that comes from being able to wear a costume or a mask, and you know, it allows them to set aside any issues with lack of confidence or you know, any insecurities, because you're not you, you're someone else. And in a safe, fun environment, that can be a lot of fun to explore. And, you know, people who have found a greater sense of confidence in being able to do that, you know, being able to feel like they're in a sense of power, where in the rest of their life, maybe they're not. You know, and about three different attractions I've worked with, a majority of their staff are women. In fact, it's often predominantly women who are coming to be actors. And many of them have said, you know, it does give them a sense of power and
awesome,
you know, authority. Yeah. And of course, there's always the other side of that, people who are just there specifically to seek out that kind of power that can then be problematic.
Yeah.
Right.
Everybody should do background checks.
You know, you got me thinking about my reason for doing it. And I think I realized my reason is because, for me personally, I mean, like my other hobbies, I'm a lock picker. I like solving puzzles. Mm-hmm. And to me, figuring out how with my skills, my costumes, and my room and my environment, I can scare someone.
Yeah.
It's like solving a very complicated puzzle or a mm-hmm. problem.
Yeah, that's, and I've heard people think of it very much in the same arena.
Okay, so I'm not crazy. Okay, good.
You know, it's a theatrical performance, and it's a theatrical performance that you get to do again and again and again and perfect it each time. So, you know, whereas if you're limited to a weekend run or something in a play, in a haunted attraction, you can do it, you know, 500 times a night and perform to different audiences and see what the reactions will be. So it can be just a fulfilling creative expression. And definitely for designers, I mean, it's just, you can let your imagination just run free and think and create about all these different things that are outside, you know, reality. So it's fulfilling just from a creative outlet kind of point of view. Of course, there's also the physical reactions that happen when you're scaring too. So just like the customers are getting scared and getting the endorphins and adrenaline, so are the actors. So they're physically, you know, very activated and feeling, you know, strong and powerful just because of the way their body is changing.
Right.
Okay. That's really interesting. All right. Well, we've got only a few more minutes left. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned a book previously. Yeah. I know Crystal's been reading it, and I'm looking forward to getting my hands on it when she's done with it and I finish the book. It's complicated. But anyways, tell us about this book. Scream is the title, and it is available where all fine books are sold, I'm assuming. And yep. The reviews of it have been absolutely amazing. But yeah, tell us about it in your words.
So the book, Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear, essentially, every chapter I tackle a different kind of component of fear. So I look at, you know, why we like thrill rides and roller coasters and what's happening in the body during those very thrilling kind of scary experiences, how the body changes. I also look at paranormal investigations and why people like to go to haunted spaces or spaces where tragedy has happened. You know, what it is, you know, reminding us of, you know, how, you know, engaging with the paranormal, it makes us think about death. It makes us think about all these scary things, but through a protective frame with a little bit of distance between us and the real, you know, end of our lives. And I go to different countries, so South America and Japan, to see how, you know, fun scary is done in different political and social environments. And all of this I link back to research and back to what sociologists and historians and psychologists have learned about humans and fear. So yeah, I would say it's really a kind of comprehensive investigation into all of these different sides of fear.
Wow. You know, I got to say, I was not at your talk at HauntCon. Crystal, we had to split up for that one. Mm-hmm. Crystal was there, and you absolutely loved it.
Yes.
I haven't seen her leaving a talk grinning like that in a very, very long time.
Oh, wonderful. That's great.
So, yes, any chance to see her speak at any conference, definitely go see Dr. Margie Kerr, definitely, and check out the book. It is Scream. I can't read that. What was the subtitle again? I apologize. I can't read it.
The Science of Fear. Yeah.
Thrilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. I have it up, but I can't read it. My eyes aren't good enough. I'm getting old.
We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And if people have questions for you, and would you be open to taking those, and where?
Oh, sure thing. So my website is margiekerr.com, margiekerr.com. And from there, you can email me. I'm also margiekerr on Twitter and Instagram. So yeah, feel free to send me a message we can talk about fear.
Absolutely. And I've got to say, your work has been absolutely fascinating.
Yes.
Your qualifications are beyond reproach. This industry is super lucky to have someone like you doing this kind of research and thinking about these issues. Because, I mean, hey, I'll be the first one to admit it. You know, we're just kids having fun. As long as I have an adult in the room explaining why this stuff works and why it's important and why it's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you guys.
Yeah. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Once again, this is Dr. Margie Kerr. The book again is Scream, Chilling Adventures in the Science of Fear. Check it out where finer books are sold. We'll have a link in our show notes. Margie, thank you again for coming to us. I have no idea why you agreed with all your credentials to spend the hour with us.
I love talking to people, so yes. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Well, I'm super glad you do. Thank you again. And
thank you.
Until next time, I'm Jonathan.
I'm Crystal.
And this has been Haunt Weekly, episode 114, interviewing Dr. Margie Kerr, the author of Scream. We will see you guys next week.